All right, as you may have guessed, we remain in Psalms 37. Take a slightly different tack this morning and see how that goes and how far we get on this. You may remember that the title slide last week was When Anger Rules, and I took a hint from the English Standard Version that talks about the fact that he does not forsake his saints. And I think that's much more appropriate for the 37th Psalm. I just about said 34th Psalm. 37th Psalm. Mickey probably has a point that he wants to show about anger, and that certainly is in here. But I wanted to go through a few other things. You will remember that I read last week out of the introduction from the commentary, in Truth Commentaries on Psalm 37. I just wanted to read that again so we get an idea of what Psalms 37 is about. The authors of that commentary say, David would often have seen the Lord's enemies flourishing temporarily while the righteous suffered hardship and persecution. In David's youth, Goliath openly defied the armies of the living God, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. David's anointing by Samuel did not lead him straight to the throne, but to a life hiding in wilderness regions with a few hundred supporters, whereas Saul, whom the Lord had rejected, continued to hold power in the palace and was able to muster an army of thousands. Many years later, Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel so that David was forced to flee into the wilderness while the wicked flourished in the palace with thousands of supporters. Yet in all these situations, David continued to trust in the Lord and was delivered, whereas the wicked soon perished and were cut off. And so that seems to me to fairly well sum up what David's attitude might have been as he was writing this psalm, in that a lot of people will see that it appears that the wicked are prospering and the righteous are being forsaken. And so we'll go and talk about that a little bit as we continue on here. I have another quotation that I want to use from that same commentary, and this is just in their comment on the first verse. And when we look at Psalms 37, we understand, as I mentioned last week, that it's an acrostic poem, meaning that sections start with letters of the Hebrew alphabet in order. And we have, I believe, the first five or six in this particular section that we're looking at, verses 1 through 9, is what we have that we're studying right now. In their commentary, they say the wicked may prosper in their wickedness. So, for example, verses 7 and 35, and seek to overthrow the righteous. And for that, we can look at verses 12, 14, and 32. But we're not to become angry or envious because of this. So that's talked about in verses 1 and 7 and 8. Because in the end, they will be cut off. And we have a whole bunch of references here. And their weapons will hurt only themselves. See verse 15. Those who depart from evil and do good will be delivered from the wicked and will inherit the earth forever. And then we have a whole plethora of passages there in verse 37 here. And so really that, just in their commentary on verse 1, we understand indeed that sort of wraps up what the entire 40 verses of Psalms 37 are about. I think that, like I put on my title, those who depart from evil and do good will be delivered from the wicked and will inherit the earth. And I think, as we discussed last week, also we need to understand the eternal consequences that could be here, that's being spoken about also. When it talks about inheriting the earth, at the time that David wrote this, certainly there were temporal blessings to be had in safety from their enemies and having the good land that they've been promised. But when we get right down to it, the spiritual aspects of the psalm are there also, in that if we stay and do the good thing, do the righteous things, even if we are hungry here on this earth, we will be filled in heaven. You remember that I think the writer of the psalm, one of the psalms, said that he hadn't seen the righteous baking bread. I think that's in Psalms, isn't it? And I think we touched on that in an earlier psalm about the righteous not baking bread. We understand that we're in the midst of a, you might say, a large family, and the family takes care of its own. Well, that's something that we can be assured of. Now, as we look at the things that David has to say in this, we start off at looking, as we look at this next slide, about the fact that within the Bible, there are numerous times that we're asked, or that are asked, why do the wicked prosper? We look, for example, at a number of different verses, but if we look at Jeremiah, the 12th chapter, in verses 1 and 2, about why does the way of the wicked prosper? If we look at Jeremiah chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, Jeremiah there says, "Righteous are you, O Lord, when I complain to you. Yet I would plead my case before you. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why do all who are treacherous thrive? You plant them and they take root. They grow and produce fruit. You are near in their mouth and far from their heart." And of course, we've stopped the reading there before we see the resolution to this matter, but what we want to focus on is the fact that many times writers in the Old Testament and sometimes in the New ask, why does the way of the wicked prosper? They wonder about this. Yes, Randy?
The passage you were talking about, the righteous, "I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his descendants begging bread," that's in this Psalm, 25.
Oh, verse 25. Okay, I knew it sounded really familiar. And it's probably in one of the verses that I listed there earlier. Another instance of why did the wicked prosper question in Job, the 21st chapter. Randy, do you have the opportunity to read that more lengthy one? Job, the 21st chapter, verses 7 through 15.
Job 21, 7 through 15. "Why do the wicked still live, continue on, also become very powerful? Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and the rod of God is not on them. His ox mates without fail, his cow calves and does not abort. They send forth their little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. They sing to the timbrel and harp, and rejoice at the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity, and suddenly they go down to Sheol. They say to God, 'Depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him?'"
Who is the Almighty that we should serve him?
Sounds like Pharaoh.
It does. You know, the thing is that this is not a, I don't want to say uncommon, but this phrase, something similar to this, is used several times in the Old Testament. Who is God that we should obey him? Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And then at the end, what profit do we get if we pray to him? Is that the American Standard, New American Standard say that?
What would we gain if we entreat him?
Entreat him, okay. All right, so the English Standard says, "And what profit do we get if we pray to him?" And that's something that I think it's important for all of us to understand, is that here in the book of Job, God is essentially telling us that it is profitable for us to pray to him, because we're mocking the fact that these people say, "What is the Almighty that we should serve him, and what profit do we get if we pray to him?" These are things that we need to be doing, and an example is being made of these people. Randy?
It also points out how long this has been going on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Job is, many consider this to be the oldest book in the Bible.
Yes.
And historians say that he was probably around the same time as Abraham.
Yeah, contemporary with Abraham is what they say, yeah.
But even at that time, there were people just like that. Who is this Almighty guy that we're supposed to bow down to?
Yeah.
And what benefit is there? They just don't know God at all. They have no clue.
Yet, interestingly enough, when Abraham was involved in the battle with the kings, right? Isn't that right? And he came down and he met Melchizedek coming as he was coming back home. And it says that Melchizedek was a priest of God Most High. Mm-hmm. I go, well, some people believed him, and then others didn't. You know, and so, yeah, we see this thing happen. Is that your hand?
Precisely the reason why God did not give the land to Abraham right then and there. He said it would be that his descendants would come back and get it, because there wasn't, the evil had not completely consumed the land.
So a reason why Abraham was not given the land at that time. Another semi-lengthy passage, Psalms, the 73rd chapter, and I think it's Psalm 73 is the one that the commentator that made those initial comments said the Psalm 73 is one to sort of read in conjunction with Psalms 37, that they say a lot of the same things. And so, feel like reading again, Randy?
Sure.
3 through 14.
Psalm 73, 3 through 14. For I was envious of the arrogant, as I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pains in their death, and their body is fat. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like mankind. Therefore pride is their necklace. The garment of violence covers them. Their eye bulges from fatness. The imaginations of their heart run riot. They mock and wickedly speak of oppression. They speak from on high. They have set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue parades through the earth. Therefore his people return to this place, and waters of abundance are drunk by them. They say, how does God know? And is there knowledge with the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, and always at ease. They have increased in wealth. Surely in vain I have kept my heart pure and washed my hands in innocence. For I have been stricken all day long and chastened every morning.
All right. So once again, we can look at this and say, well, as David writes this, we can understand that he pleads to God and it appears that he doesn't get an answer. Of course, if we continue in context, we can see that that's not the case. And so same thing in Psalms 37. Randy,
I can read through 17 if you'd like.
If you'd like.
Yeah. If I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. When I pondered to understand this, it was troublesome in my mind, until I came into the sanctuary of God, then I perceived their end.
Right. And we've discussed that before. You know, go into the sanctuary of God and you see what the end of the evil people is going to be by the words that you hear and read in there. Carolyn?
I think too, we look around us today and you hear people say, and you may think, oh my goodness, it's so bad today. It's never been worse than today. It's always been bad. It's no different. Things go in cycles where it looks like things are better, or looks like things are worse, but some things will always be.
Yeah, and once again, your comment, Randy, about when we look at this and realize how ancient these books are, and realize that people have said, what is the Almighty that we should serve Him since the beginning of time, as it were. I think Cain, when he killed Abel, you know, thought essentially the same thing.
God spoke directly to him. Warning.
Yeah. And he says, am I my brother's keeper? I go, well, I guess not anymore, since you just killed him. And then if we contrast this about the asking of why do the wicked prosper, we can see though that, as we've mentioned, that their prosperity does not live forever. If we look at the 20th verse of this psalm, Psalms 37 and 20, it says, but the wicked will perish. The enemies of the Lord are like the glory of the pastures. They vanish like smoke. They vanish away. And so even in this psalm that we have here that asks sometimes, why did the wicked prosper? We also have an answer. And as we look on the next slide, we'll see that we have a question and an answer, a question and an answer, as it were, or a statement and an answer perhaps. And then, in Proverbs, the third chapter, in verses 31 to 35, the writer there says, do not envy a man of violence, and do not choose any of his ways. For the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, but the upright are in his confidence. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners he is scornful, but to the humble he gives favor. The wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace. once again, we have to understand many times the spiritual consequences of this, because even though here it says, I have not seen the righteous begging bread, the fact of the matter is that the righteous do go hungry from time to time. The righteous are homeless from time to time. Once again, though, I say we have a big family to help us and to help take care of us when we fall on times like this. We're not guaranteed prosperity in this life, but we are guaranteed prosperity in the life to come if we'll simply follow after these words that have been written down for us to look at and read and understand. Look in Proverbs, the 24th chapter, in verses 19 and 20, where it talks, where this is the other one where it uses the word fret, the word I don't like. In this instance, the Hebrew word that's used here, fret, or fret, I mean, it's the same one about anger. Okay, fret not yourselves because of evildoers, and be not envious of the wicked. For the evil man has no future. The lamp of the wicked will be put out. And of course, that particular phrase right there is very similar to what we have here in Psalms 37. So we see that even though many times the question is asked, why do the wicked prosper? Many times also, or in each time, God answers that and says that their prosperity will not last forever, but the prosperity of the righteous will. And that's what we need to hope on when we look at these words. And so when we look at this next slide, I used this slide last week also, talking about the fact that this is an acrostic poem. I've added some more though to the letters that are being used, the Hebrew letters that are being used, and what verses. And as we look through Psalms chapter 37. We see that it's grouped by these Hebrew letters, and approximately every other verse starts with a new letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And of course, by the time we get through verse 20, we've gone through all 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. But as we look at this, and I mentioned last time that verses 1 and 2 have the first Hebrew letter, Aleph. And they continue on there. But it's interesting to note that in, I don't know whether it's Semitic writing or Hebrew writing or what, there is a tendency to make a statement and then repeat it in different words, sort of for emphasis. And you see that done many times in the Old Testament. I don't know that we see it in Greek writing in the New Testament, but we see it numerous times in the Old Testament. So, for example, yeah, Randy.
I didn't want to interrupt, but you mean like in Proverbs, that's done a lot in Proverbs.
Yeah. It does, yeah, that's right. Proverbs does that a lot.
My question, though, is so in the acrostic, the Aleph versus 1, so as we see the division of the verses, 1 and 2 both begin with that verse? With that letter?
No, just one begins with that letter.
One begins that, and then three begins with the next letter.
With B, yeah.
Okay. So as a section, then. Yeah, one or two are...
Right. So one and two are together, three and four are together, five and six are together, seven is by itself, and eight and nine are together. And so when we look at those, it appears that they go together sort of to make up a context. And as I just picked out a few of the words that are there. In verses 1 and 2, it talks about fret not. In verses 3 and 4, it talks about trust and delight. In verses 5 and 6, it talks about commit. And verse 7, be still, wait patiently. And verses 8 and 9, refrain from anger. Is how these verses start off. And so when we look at verses 1 and 2, in the American Standard, for example, it says, fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against them, that work unrighteousness, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. So that appears to be a context, because now in 3 and 4 it says, trust in Jehovah and do good. So at verse 1 it says, fret not thyself. Now in verse 3 it says, trust in Jehovah. Trust in Jehovah and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on his faithfulness. Delight thyself also in Jehovah, and he will give thee the desires of thy heart. And so in the trust and the delight that we have here, we see also that we're looking in contrast to the evildoers or the unrighteous people. And then verses, what is it, 5 and 6? Yeah. It says, commit thy way unto Jehovah. Trust also in him, and he will bring it to pass. And he will make thy righteousness to go forth as the light. Once again, he's assuring us of the rewards, as it were, of righteousness. That how important it is for that to be something that we commit ourselves to. And verse 7 talks about resting in Jehovah. Rest in Jehovah and wait patiently for him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. But once again, it uses the word fret, and this is talking about anger. And it's important that we understand that we're not to be angry. Now, as I look at this, and I look at this word fret, we see a couple of other words for anger in the Hebrew that are used here also. Who are we angry at? I think that's a problem. Because if we're angry at God, then we may be in trouble. Now, we do have a few other verses that indicate that people are angry at the people that prosper. And I can see how that would be the case. I mean, if this is a wicked person and he's prospering, you're still going to be angry at him anyway, because he's doing evil things, you know, beating up your kids or whatever, you know, stealing your land. And we just need to make sure that when we look at this, we understand that if we fret, in other words, if we're angry, that anger is not channeled towards God. We can look at, as I mentioned last week, when Uzzah died because he touched the Ark of the Covenant, it said that David was angry. And then he went and stored the Ark of the Covenant in another place. David was angry. It doesn't say he was angry at God, but I'm not sure who David would be angry at unless he's angry at Uzzah that's lying dead on the ground. Maybe he was angry at himself, because later on we realize that he came to the conclusion about what? About the transportation of the Ark of the Covenant. That it was being transported improperly.
By ox cart.
By ox cart. Rather than what?
On the shoulders of the...
Shoulders of the priests, right? Or the Levites, I guess. I don't know whichever one. Priests, probably, if it's the Ark of the Covenant. They're supposed to, the bars that were going, that go through the little rings that are on the Ark of the Covenant, the bars go through that and they carry it on their shoulders. Not on an ox cart. David was angry. Perhaps he was just angry at himself. But the implication there in just saying David was angry seems to imply that he was angry with God, because God struck him, Uzzah, down. Yeah, Randy.
I think it's possible to be angry and not necessarily have it directed at someone. I mean, that's, you know, grumblers, just angry at life itself. Just, you know, why do things have to be this way? Sort of like Eeyore with a cloud over your head.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yep. There's a lot of Eeyores around at work.
Yeah. It made me think of James 1:20.
James 1:20.
Really, 19 and 20. This you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. So that's really what we're talking about, is when you've crossed over the line.
Yes.
Of not achieving the righteousness of God. Anger has a tendency to make us speak and say things that we shouldn't say. Think things that we shouldn't think.
Yes. Indeed it does. Yeah.
But it's in contrast to being in control.
Right.
If you're in control, then you don't have to get angry. It's kind of like, you know, Paul said he's learned to be content in good circumstances and bad. You know, in prosperity and I forgot how it reads now, but contentment. To be able to be content whether you're rich or poor, because you know that God's in control. And that if you do his will, there's a reward at the end.
Yes.
And there's punishment at the end for the others.
Right.
For all those that you tend to want to get angry at, there's punishment for them waiting unless they change. But there's no sin in being rich. You know, rich people can be saved too. Jesus said it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. But then he also said all things are possible with God.
Right.
So the point being, just because somebody's rich, there's no reason to think that it was gained dishonestly.
Right.
Some people have honest gain.
Much like Zacchaeus down in Jericho, right? We assume since he was a chief tax collector that his gains were done dishonestly, but there's no indication that that's the case. Though when we see the conversation with Zacchaeus, he says, if I've wronged anybody, I give back fourfold and all that sort of stuff. So Zacchaeus seems to have been a person that apparently was prosperous, and I'm sure the people hated him because he was a tax collector. But there's no indication that he was an unrighteous person. Now, Carolyn.
Weren't both Job and Abraham considered to be very wealthy?
Very well.
Indeed they were, Job and Abraham, yeah. One of the, I think, doesn't Job say that he was like, the book of Job say that he was like the richest person in the area, the world or whatever?
Blessed with the world's goods.
Yeah.
But it's still blessings.
Yeah. So your comment about, Randy, about, keeping control. You know, God has told us that we need to control our brains. Now, that's difficult for us to do. Sometimes we wish that there was an on-off switch here, that we could turn off that anger or those unrighteous thoughts and deeds. Carolyn?
And some of the answer to that is going to be coming up in verse 7, where it tells us what to do.
Lock it, right?
Zip the lip.
Zip the lip. That's right. That's right here, right? That says it. Yeah, the American Standard says zip the lip. I don't know where we've gotten to, but all right. So 5 and 6, you know, that's the third Hebrew letter, Gimel. And it talks about committing your way to Jehovah. Trust also in Him, and He will bring it to pass. And He will make thy righteousness to go forth as the light, and thy justice as the noonday. You know, this psalm is not negative. This psalm is giving us a lot of hope and ideas here about things that we need to do. And so when he says, commit yourself to the Lord, that's important for us to think about. And not, as he's going to continue to say on here, fret yourself about the things that are going on. So whether we think of the word fret as in the Hebrew definition here of hot burning anger, or the English definition of worry, both of them are things that we need to be concerned about. We're not supposed to worry about this. What is it? Matthew chapter 6, part of the Sermon on the Mount. The half that chapter is about Jesus saying, don't worry about things. God knows what you need. You know, he talks about the birds and flowers and the things like that. And he says, but they're just here for an instant. Essentially, it's a reiteration of what Solomon said, you know, trust God and keep his commandments, because this is the whole of man. And so Jesus is kind of reiterating and expanding on that in the Sermon on the Mount to a certain extent. So verses 1 and 2, fret not. Verses 3 and 4, trust in the light. Verses 5 and 6, commit yourself to the Lord. And then verse 7 by itself, rest in Jehovah and wait patiently for him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. Now we can see here where the word fret, as the Hebrew definition of hot burning anger, might come in here. This man, it says at the end of that verse, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. And so I think we can see that that's something that's, you know, sort of impinging on us and the things that we want to do for righteousness' sake. Randy?
New American Standard says, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes.
Carries out wicked schemes. Okay, yeah. What did this one say? Oh, who bringeth wicked devices to pass. So carries out wicked schemes. Yeah. And all of us, I think, we can look around, and those of us who wouldn't include me have look at the news on the TV or read the newspaper. I think they still make those things. I'm not sure. And you look at the wicked devices of people all over the place, and how well they're doing. Even in class, last Wednesday, LaTanya said that she had been watching something on TV and there was this guy that was preaching something and it was obviously in error. Yet you note these people that they've got these huge church buildings, you know, made out of glass and crystal and, you know, covered with gold and all those things. You might indeed fret yourself about those people, that why are they so prosperous? But the important thing to remember is that God has talked about them and their evil devices and has said that even if we don't see them get what we might call their comeuppance here in this life, this is just the training ground for the life to come. And so that's why we need to train our mind and do what God has said and keep evil thoughts out of our brains. Tough thing to do, especially when, you know, you've gotten used to it. It's hard to get rid of a habit. You have to rehabituate yourself. And that takes a while and takes effort and it takes, you know, dedication to try and do that.
That's verse 5 of commit.
Commit. That's right.
You have to keep on doing it. It doesn't just happen one day.
Right, right. So commitment is not just something, yes, that you just, you know, okay, well, I'll do this today. You know, commitment is something, a long term, as you say. I have a footnote in the American Standard. What does it say? Oh, yeah. There was a comment in the commentary about this, because the Hebrew says, for commit thy way unto Jehovah. The Hebrew says, roll thy way upon Jehovah. And they made a comment about, well, it's, you know, it's like rolling a big rock. It's something that you have to push on, something you have to do in order to roll a big rock. Not sure how I understand the Hebrew that way, but I think I perhaps like this reference better. In the New American, what does it say there? And on the commit place, verse 5, what does the first phrase say?
Commit your way to the Lord.
Oh,
trust also in him and he will do it.
Okay, so commit is commit. All right. Verse 7, we talked about that. It says, be still, or wait patiently. And then verses 8 and 9 sort of, I think, sum up what we've been talking about in the first 9 verses of this chapter, when it says, cease from anger and forsake wrath, fret not thyself, it tendeth only to evil doing. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for Jehovah, they shall inherit the land. Or there's a footnote that says, inherit the earth. And so in verses 11, 22, 29, and 34. So when we look at verses 8 and 9, it's sort of, I think, summing up the discussion that we've had at least in the first 9 verses. Of course, there's many verses left to go, and we have a number of things to look at regarding that. But when he says to cease from anger and forsake wrath, both of those, and I think we discussed, Randy, I think you had asked last time about the anger and the wrath here, that yes, those are two different Hebrew words, and there were other nuances to it. And last week, of course, I went right to the Greek and showed you. I go, no, that's not right. It's Hebrew. So, yeah. So there are nuances here to the word for anger and forsake. And I don't think the anger and forsake that are here are the same as the fret that's in verse 1 or wherever the other one is, verse 7. I believe they're different words. So I believe we have 3 different words here in the Hebrew for this anger. So the fret one is the chara, and these other two are, I think Jenny mentioned something about the other two when she looked them up last week. I wanted to just remind us that this is not the only acrostic psalm or acrostic poem in the book of Psalms. So we have about 8 more that are written this way. And what was our conclusions, which are obviously at the bottom of the screen, that the reason for doing this? Memorization, right? That's one of the best things to do. So many people, they try to use acrostics to make sure that we can remember things. So I unfortunately learned a couple of acrostics in electronics school in the Navy, which helped me to remember the color code for resistors. But unfortunately, given that it was in the Navy, they're not things that I would even think about repeating. But the you know, even to this day, I remember what the color codes for resistors are. So, because of an acrostic.
Acronyms is what we often call them.
Acronyms is way up. Acronyms, which, yeah.
An acrostic is often a like a more of a poem.
Yes, true.
But an acronym is somehow naming something so that the first letter spells something sort of
right.
memorable.
Right.
I had one yesterday when I was studying in my class. There was an acrostic that it was the word prompt, so it's quite a long one.
Oh yeah.
So things that we see regularly, like SOS, stands for what?
Ship.
Depends on what you think of, but normally it's save our ship, right? I brought this up in class a number of years ago, and Katie and Emily were in there, and probably Caitlin and a few others. And I mentioned, well, we were talking about abbreviations. I said, like scuba. And they all went,
yeah.
It's like self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. Is what scuba means. It's not just a word. So that's an acronym and not an acrostic because it's not a poem or it's not leading anywhere, as it were. It's just helping you to memorize. But these things help us quite a bit. So yeah. So that's and also the idea of a sense of completeness. Also, if we look at this, so we got the. Tav. So Tav is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So we've got Aleph through Tav in here. It's like our A to Z, or the Greek Alpha to Omega. It can show a sense of completeness or fullness. That's important also for us to keep in mind that perhaps there's writing styles like this to show a sense of completeness in addition to doing really helpful things like helping us to memorize them. I also mentioned that there's acrostics in Proverbs, Lamentations, and Nahum. And so they have used this style of writing, or we might say that God has chosen this style of writing in those particular areas for a particular purpose. And perhaps it was important for people to memorize the things that were there also in these particular books. Randy?
In my Bible, and I don't know if this is, you know, all different translations have this, but New American Standard, in Psalm 119, the letters are spelled out for you at the top of each section.
Yes, indeed they are.
So,
and each section is 8 verses long.
8 verses long.
All the way through. So all 176 verses divided up into 22 Hebrew letters. Does 8 times 22 equal 176? It does. It does equal 176. That makes sense. So, I've noticed that. And was it further subdivided into book one? No, that's just the Psalms itself. Book one, book two through like book five, I think.
They didn't do that on these other acrostics. I kind of wonder why. If the other ones are broken down into acrostics, because some of those aren't very long. You know, 9 and 10.
No, right. And 9 and 10, I mentioned last week, were supposed to sort of be together, as opposed to be separate psalms. And some of them are really short. I think 119 is a little longer though.
A little bit.
Just a touch.
145 is only 21 verses.
So that's sort of my introduction to this psalm. I think it takes us to perhaps an understanding of how important it is for us to look at the comparisons between what people think and what God's going to do. Too many times we feel persecuted when in fact it's our own fault. It's an interesting psalm. Of course, I guess all the psalms are interesting. I think that it's a good thing for us to look at it at the depth of these things and how how God has caused this psalm to be written down for our comfort. Yes.
I was just going to say that the translators always put a little sub or a little heading at the top of each one to just kind of summarize.
Yep.
And this summary, I think, is really good for Psalm 37. It says, security of those who trust in the Lord and insecurity of the wicked.
That's almost exactly what the American Standard has. The only difference was that they used Jehovah instead of the Lord.
But it's a great summary. I mean, it really does. If you had to put all this into one sentence, that's what it's about.
Yeah, and I was thinking about putting that on the title slide, but I thought that's too long. So I took what the English Standard Version had and just sort of modified it a little bit. But
that's really what it's emphasizing. This psalm emphasizes that those who trust in the Lord can feel secure, and those who don't can't.
Right.
I mean, there's no security in wickedness.
Though you look at the psalm right before that, it says, wickedness of men and loving kindness of God. Yeah, I don't know if that's because they're part of the same genre that we were looking at. I know that in the outline thing that we were looking at as to how to put the psalms together, mm-hmm. that we had several different genres of psalms. I forget which one this is called. And we'll have to look at that one of these days, perhaps next week. I just want to, in the minute and 20 seconds that's left, I just wanted to look at this next slide. Essentially, the title of it. And if we look at Psalms 37, it's let God take care of it. That's, I think, the important lesson that we're supposed to learn out of this, is that it's God that's going to take care of things. That it's not up to us to be angry or envious or to put things right in a way other than just preaching the gospel or showing people how a person ought to be righteous. What did God say?
Vengeance is mine.
Vengeance is mine. I will recompense.
And I sometimes when I feel that frustration, I think, what can I even do to that person compared to what God has planned for the evil? You know,
yeah.
I'm nothing.
Right. Yet, so many Westerns, you see things like, you know, people quote them, vengeance is mine,
yeah.
Saith the Lord. Yeah. Or, I hope you know Jesus because you're about to meet him type thing. You go, well, that's not exactly what God was talking about. So, all right. Well, we're gonna stop at that. And we'll take up perhaps next week on the same chart that we're going to take up with this week. That we didn't because I had other charts that I added. So, thank you for your time.